Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. We're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. David is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. Go to the website, askelm.com. You can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And before we get started, I'm just very excited about this. David and I are going to be doing some more work on this Sons of God issue. It's a huge, huge subject. So from there, right now, we will, you know me. I'm just, that subject is just very important to me. We are beginning file number 16 in our 101 Bible Secrets. And you can read 101 Bible Secrets online for free at the website askelm.com. You can follow along with these audio files if you would like to. And I believe today we start with secret number 98. Right, David?
That's correct. Good to be back.
Yes, it's good to have you back. And thank you for doing that situation, that audio file that we did about this phony baloney. Jesus, we found his tomb. We found his bone box. They didn't read the book, David, because Jesus took all of his stuff with him. You know?
That's right.
Yeah.
All his bones were gone.
Yes.
And it's like they want people to say, oh, well, look at this empty box. This proves that Jesus wasn't resurrected.
They're terrified of that, because if that's true, then the kingdom of God is true. And that's very threatening to these world powers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's very threatening to Satan. So any Christian out there that's weak-kneed and sitting on the fence, and also the Christian haters, just, fall over when they hear, oh, my gosh, we found the tomb of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
Game's over. No,
it's not. Oh.
So.
Okay, I will leave you alone now and let you get to our secret number 98.
Okay, we're in chapter 11 of 101 Bible Secrets, and Bible secret number 98 asks the question, did Noah have a rain gauge? And in other words, what were the waters in the firmament that came down to earth finally? And in what form were they before they came to earth? Well, an interesting question now presents itself, because, and as we discussed in the earlier Bible Secrets, I think 96, 97, if 15 cubits of water, which is about 276 inches of rainfall, descended upon the earth, where did all the water have its origin? In other words, where did it all come from?
Right.
And that is what we want to determine, if possible. And of course, the answer is in the Bible itself. And since the results of the flood, and we're still living in a post-flood world, of course, according to Moses, the effects and the results of the flood were worldwide. And it can be reasonably believed that there was a uniform, or practically so, a uniform amount of rainfall over the entire globe during the time of the flood. After all, Moses tells us that all life in which there was the breath of air perished in this prodigious downpouring. And great amounts of water must have been located somewhere above the earth and somehow encircling it. And indeed, this is what Moses tells us in the first creation account. On the second day of God's creation plan, he separated the waters which were above the firmament. This is a term, firmament. This is a term in which the Bible describes any region separated from the surface of the earth. This would be the lithosphere, as we would call it today, into the outermost parts of space, even where the lunar, the moon and other planetary bodies exist, and the stars. And this watery reservoir is depicted in the book of Genesis in the same way as the oceans. And this seems to show that it was some kind of watery mass above the earth, which was quite visible from earth. And from the account of Moses, it could be understood that this water was either in a liquid or a solid, a frozen state. And this is in Genesis chapter 1, verses 6 to 10. Now, since Moses tells us in chapters 7 and 8 of Genesis that, quote, the windows, or the floodgates, the windows of heaven were opened, which caused, 15 cubits of water, which is about 276 inches of water, to descend on the earth in 30 days. And he further says that those 15 cubits of water came mostly from above. Now, this would indicate that much of this watery mass that was once visible from earth is no longer in its former position above the earth. It's all been brought down. Now, this water, which was once in space, has come to earth and is now part of the oceans and is found in some of the basin areas of the world, like the Caspian Sea and the Great Lakes in the United States. This must be the case because, after all, no one since the time of the flood has recorded being able to look into the heavens to see this reservoir of water located within the planetary environment of this earth. But in the first chapter of Genesis, Moses seems to show that this watery reservoir could be seen in the pre-flood period. Now, there's one important point to be aware of in regard to this watery mass. Since Moses recorded that the sun and the moon and even the stars, those normally visible to the naked eye, were capable of being seen by the fourth day of creation, and this is in Genesis chapter 1, verses 14 to 19. This watery reservoir could not have been some type of canopy or cloud mass that surrounded the complete sphere of the earth. The stars, which were part of the heavenly host that helped give the signs on earth to determine periods of time, according to Genesis 1:14, stars would not normally be seen through such a watery mantle like heavy clouds, unless there were extensive breaks or clear areas in various parts of the canopy. But what was this watery reservoir that was located above the earth? Is there some type of indication in the Bible that might identify it in greater detail to inform us what it really was? Well, Dr. Martin says that indeed there was. And interestingly, the account in which it occurs also speaks about the increase of water in the ocean, the shorelines leaving their former positions and coming more inland, at a time when the wicked were destroyed from the earth. And this is found in a section of Scripture in which God is speaking about his creative and judgmental powers in matters dealing with the physical attributes of nature within the heavens and the earth. And this account is recorded in Job, chapter 38, verses 8 to 16. Now, let's examine this. The Bible describes an event in which wicked men were destroyed out of the earth. This is in Job 38, verses 13 and 15. So, at this time of destruction, this had to have occurred since the time of Adam, since the time of the first man. The destruction also had to have happened before the time of Job, probably about the time of Job was about 100 years before the birth of Moses. This is because God called Job's attention to it. Job was fully aware of this major judgment by God. And interestingly, this judgment involved the waters of the oceans as well as the waters above the oceans. And this record in the book of Job speaks of a time when God had set the boundaries of the oceans. In other words, the shorelines were established at the time the original waters of the ocean burst forth from the womb. And this is expressed in Job chapter 38, verse 8. This could have been a poetic reference to the fountains of the deep mentioned by Moses in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, from whence came the original waters that made up the oceans from the time of Adam until the time of Noah. But then, Job says that something happened. In the book of Job it says, while the original oceans had clouds associated with them, and there was something else connected with the oceans called, in the book of Job, quote, the thick darkness, end quote, that resembled a, quote, swaddling band. This is in Job 38, verse 9. What was this band-like darkness that was positioned somewhere above the ocean? Well, Lang's commentary says that the Hebrew word that describes this band is so unique and emphatic that only the deepest darkness can adequately illustrate its essential meaning. Besides that, Lang's commentary informs us that the Hebrew word has the connotation of a dropping or a distillation, and that it denotes, quote, a kind of flowing or floating darkness having some kind of black visibility. And this is in Lang's commentary, volume 4, page 155. And the italics that Dr. Martin uses in the book are actually theirs. I tried to emphasize some of this stuff. This mass of, quote, whatever it was, unquote, appeared as a swath of darkness, looking like a swaddling band that was located over the oceans, and its blackness, and perhaps its shadow, was clearly visible to people on the earth. In other words, it would have blacked out the stars as it would proceed around the earth, and you probably would have been able to see the curvature of it. Like today, you can look up in the sky and see the a Milky Way.
Yeah.
Well, this would have been something very close and very dark in a ring from horizon to horizon, the opposite of a rainbow, except it would be up there in the sky. And imagine the blackness of this thing obscuring the stars. Now, there's probably other indications in pagan writings that have come through the flood, but, you know, they've all been probably garbled, and, you know, they probably don't add much information. But, you know, whatever it was, like I said, it was clearly visible to people on earth, and indeed, there's a certain mysteriousness about the meaning of the word. The scholars who wrote the Lang's commentary, for example, did not know exactly what was being described by this account in the book of Job. They felt compelled to transliterate the word, which indicated an intensely dark band. They simply rendered it the dark Arafel, for its swaddling band. Well, what was this dark band over the oceans called in Hebrew the Arafel? Well, whatever it was, the light of the sun, the moon, and the stars could not penetrate through its mass, simply because the book of Job said that it somehow presented the aspect of a black band above the earth. Apparently, this was even in the daytime. And yet, in some way, it was associated with water. It was some kind of flowing or floating darkness, which had to do with the dropping of liquid by some distillation process. And this would be the meaning if one is allowed to wring every bit of meaning out of the word Arafel. And certainly water was associated with it, and it was primarily situated above some part of the oceans. And we have to remember that the aspect is generally from the Middle East. So, you know, oceans would mean the Mediterranean or the Arabian Sea, south of the Saudi Arabia today, which is probably the area of where Job lived at that time, somewhere around there, certainly toward the south, not the north, and or perhaps in Sinai, what today is called Sinai. But this dark band, something happened to this dark Arafal. After stating that it looked like a swaddling band over the oceans, Job chapter 38, verse 9 says, and says, quote, and I broke my boundary or decree for it, end quote. The King James translates it, quote, and break up it for it my decreed place, end quote. Now, this shows that the decree of God kept this Arafal in place over the ocean, and that it was this decree was suddenly rescinded. He broke the barrier for its place. And this resulted in the shorelines of the oceans, as the next verse, verse 10 of Job 38 shows. The oceans were changed because a new set of bars and doors had to be made for those ocean areas. Now, in Hebrew, the use of the term bars and doors for the ocean simply means their shorelines or coastlines. So what we see in this section of Job is a description of the former doors or shorelines of the original oceans. And this is in 38 verse 8 of Job. These original shorelines, these doors, were disturbed by God by breaking up the decreed place for the dark Arafal. This is in verse 9. This brought about new bars and doors for the oceans in verse 10, discussed in verse 10.
David, is this, could we look upon the terminology that's being used as ancient scientific language?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very descriptive.
Okay.
And what we, it's very likely also that all the planets had rings around them, just like Saturn. Jupiter has a set of rings just like Saturn, but they're so faint they can't be seen unless you have a very powerful telescope. And so do the other gas giant planets, Uranus and Neptune. They all have rings, all four of them. And it wasn't until, you know, I don't know exactly when, but recently in terms of astronomy, that they, you know, only Saturn was known to have rings. Well, what Dr. Martin is proposing, whether this was a solid ring of ice or whether this was a series of ice chunks and snowballs like are around Saturn, but you can look on Saturn. I've even seen it with a telescope, and you can see the shadow that the rings form on the surface, on the gaseous surface of the planet Saturn. I mean, I've seen it with telescopes, even without pictures. And you can go on and just get pictures of Saturn. So if you were on Saturn, underneath the shadow of the ring, it would literally be a band of darkness from the surface of Saturn. So, these new bars and doors for the oceans, or as it says in the King James Version, quote, in verse 10, of Job 38, quote, hitherto shall you come, but no further, and here shall your proud waves be stayed, end quote. This all occurred at a time when the wicked were destroyed out of the earth. And this is according to verses 13 and 15. This seems clearly to refer to the judgment of God when the windows or the floodgates of heaven were opened at the time of Noah's flood. Now, with this in mind, let's see if we can identify further what this mysterious dark Arafal actually was. Since it's certain that humans from the time of Adam to Noah were able to view the stars in heaven and that the heavenly bodies could be used for signs even then, and that is, in other words, to measure times and seasons, it is not possible that it was a total canopy or mantle of thick clouds or water vapor that totally blanketed the earth in the pre-flood period. even in the book of Job, clouds or any visible water vaporous phenomena are actually distinguished from this dark Arafel in Job 38:9. And indeed, we're plainly told by God, as recorded in verse 9, that the dark Arafel was like a swaddling band, not like a blanket that would cover the whole earth. So a swaddling band is a very different thing. It's the type of cloth that provides a swath of protection encircling the body of an infant. This description is a major clue as to what the dark Arafel was. God was saying to the patriarch Job that there was once some kind of a dark watery band or ring around the earth that was so thick that it caused darkness to appear on parts of the ocean surface. And this surely means that at certain places on earth, the sun was obscured by the presence of this dark Arafel in the heavens. Now, what we find in Job 38:9 described is a ring of water circling the earth, either in a liquid or a solid form, frozen. This ring must have been like the rings around the planet Saturn, as I mentioned earlier, which, by the way, are basically also made up of water or ice particles, as far as they can tell. And they can pretty well tell from, reflections and that sort of thing. And, but not only does Saturn have rings of water around it, scientists have now found, exactly like I said earlier, through recent space exploration, that the planets Jupiter, Neptune, and Uranus also have rings around them. Indeed, Dr. Esposito, chairman of the Voyager Rings Science Working Group, has stated that all the planets in our solar system may well have had rings around them at one time, and that includes the Earth. This is in Astronomy Magazine, September 1987, pages 9 to 17. But I knew I'd read that somewhere, but I had remembered it from this article, from this secret.
This is fascinating.
When one looks at the statements in the earlier parts of the Bible, this is precisely what the Bible describes. But instead of being millions or even billions of years ago, this watery ring, which surrounded this earth from the time of Adam to Noah, became extinct just over 4,300 years ago. Now that water, which was probably ice, that made up the ring, or the rings, system around the earth, was the major cause of the flood of Noah. There may have been 1,000 or more explanations what caused the water rings to slow down and enter the earth's atmosphere. We don't know. We can only speculate. Primarily because we don't know the exact nature of what the Arafel was like. So it's just speculation. What we have to realize that God said he, quote, broke up the dark Arafel, end quote, and then the waters came down to earth. In other words, a direct act by God himself, then there were additional waters that came from below, but most of them came from above. And the Bible tells us that 15 cubits of water, about 276 inches, which could be measured by a rain gauge, if Noah had it, came down from the heavens. And this information can actually give scientists the clues to accurately calculate the amount of mass of that watery ring system that once circled the earth. Water coming from this ring system around the earth, which raised the level of the oceans about 23 feet high. And with the runoff from the land areas of the earth, we must think that the oceans were increased in depth by about a total of 30 feet. And thus, as stated in the previous question of this book, question number 97, the Persian Gulf was probably about 30 feet lower in depth before the flood of Noah. So the flood raised the level of the oceans about 30 feet. Now, there's a lot of study being done about the Black Sea and how at one time there was a separation between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, and that the Black Sea might have actually been a freshwater lake, much like the Caspian Sea farther to the east.
Haven't they found artifacts, ancient, very ancient artifacts in the Black Sea?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And they're about 30 feet difference, actually offshore, down from the original depth. And what happened was that the ocean at some time, and I don't know if it was during the flood or after, broke this land bridge barrier where Constantinople is, separating the Black Sea. Now there's a strait, but this was solid earth at one time. It broke this and washed over and killed everything that was on the shorelines of the Black Sea because the water rushed in a huge tsunami from the Mediterranean Sea. Now, when this happened, whether it was post-flood or immediately after the flood, or, you know, may have been several hundred years after the flood, we don't know. But it was actually the same James Cameron who was working with, who's the guy who found the Titanic? I think his name starts with a B. But anyway, the fellow who discovered the Titanic has done considerable archaeological work using the deep diving equipment in the Black Sea, trying to determine some findings and datings and things. So this will be an interesting thing to watch in the future to see if it's related to the flood or whether it was a disaster that happened afterwards. We can't tell. Well, anyway, back to the Bible secret. Some might say that such a thing could hardly seem possible. Well, the truth is, there's no difficulty in understanding the dynamics of nature that this interpretation about a swaddling band actually suggests. Such things are shown as being possible in an article in the prestigious journal from Britain called The New Scientist, published in May 12, 1988. The article is titled, quote, "Snowballs from Space Filled the Earth's Oceans," end quote. This article shows that there was not the slightest problem in believing that great chunks of ice could enter the atmosphere of the Earth from outer space, and that such a bombardment of ice chunks could very well raise the level of the ocean.
You know, that's interesting because isn't it in the book of Revelation where they talk about the giant hailstones that'll come down?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, they come from somewhere.
Yeah.
they don't necessarily come from our atmosphere. So there might be, they've suspected that there's asteroid-like objects that contain ice, and in fact, the asteroids themselves might contain ice. There's a new movie coming out about, on the Sci-Fi Channel, I guess, about the moon breaking up and falling to Earth. Well, some of those ice chunks may have gone to the moon, which would be the hailstones exactly that you're talking about, covered up by moon dust. And, you know, if they find water on the moon, then that would be very, very, very useful. Then you could start agriculture and use hydroponics and everything else on the moon. At least that's what some speculate.
Maybe they already are.
Maybe. But this is speculation to you and me.
Yes.
But, you know, the article in this publication, New Scientist, from May 12, 1988, shows that scientists were beginning to recognize that some of the waters of our oceans may very well have come from outer space. And this is exactly what the book of Job actually says happened when the dark Arafel broke up. So that's Bible secret number 98. Did Noah have a rain gauge? Well, he could have, and we don't know, but he would have had to have been a big one, about 23 feet. About 30 feet is what it would have, 23 to 33 feet. He would have had to dump it out every day.
Yeah.
So 23 feet of rain in 30 days. Mm. You know, that's about 8 inches a day every day, I think. So, let's see, 23 divided by 30, some other time. when I have more time. But so that's Bible secret number 98. Bible secret number 99 was, what was the effect of the ring system which was around the earth? In other words, how did it affect conditions on the earth while the ring was in place? Well, Dr. Martin's answer is as follows. The presence of this dark Arafel encircling the earth in pre-flood times brought chaos to climatic conditions in many areas of the earth. Only in the Garden of Eden, or in the general area of Eden itself, was there relatively good conditions for humans to live. Remember, outside of the garden was the area of Eden, and outside of Eden was the land of Nod. And it was called a wilderness, and not only represented the wilderness of outside the tabernacle and the temple, outside the sanctuary, but it actually was a wilderness at the time of Adam and Eve, and that's why they had to scrape by to live as punishment for the sin. Even in some parts of Eden, the ground would not yield its strength because of lack of rain. And this is in Genesis chapter 2, verse 9. Now, with not as much water on earth in the antediluvian period, weather patterns that we know of today were not in evidence. In fact, the earth was quite unpleasant to live, a place to live at that time. For those who resided outside the garden, a type of curse was placed on all the areas of the earth, even in Eden itself. And this is in Genesis chapter 3, verses, I believe, 7 to 10. There's a typo here. That particular curse lasted until Noah came on the scene. Noah's father, Lamech, said that sometime within Noah's lifetime, that particular curse would be lifted from the earth. And this is in Genesis chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. The very name Noah itself means, quote, comfort, end quote. And in the days of this man named Comfort, God said that he would remove the curse that existed throughout the antediluvian world. Indeed, after the flood, that particular curse and the effects of the dark Arafel were removed from influencing the earth. This is in Genesis chapter 8, verses 21 and 22. Now, after the flood was over, Noah was, for the first time, able to see a rainbow after experiencing a period of a type of rainfall that we are familiar with today. In other words, there was not as much water vapor. There was never enough water vapor to cause a rainbow in the atmosphere, which is interesting because, conditions of the dinosaurs seem to indicate very verdant and very lush ferns and everything. And a very interesting situation. So, I don't have all the answers, and neither does Dr. Martin. But sticking with the scriptures, after the flood, that particular curse was removed from influencing the earth. After the flood was over, Noah was, as I said, able to view the rainbows. And this was the covenant sign, the rainbow, that God gave to all mankind, that there would never again be a flood of waters like that in the time of Noah. And why did this occur? Well, this was because the dark Arafel was broken up, and it no longer surrounded the earth in an intensely dark swaddling band. The climatic conditions which existed in the antediluvian world, because of the influence of that dark Arafel, were no longer present in the earth's environment after the flood of Noah. Now, God promised Noah, quote, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. This is in Genesis chapter 8, verse 22. This is a clear indication that before the flood, all of these factors of nature concerning seed time, harvest, cold, cold, heat, summer, winter, day and night, were upset and seriously disturbed throughout many of the areas of the earth. And imagine what a big swaddling band of ice chunks, or solid ice perhaps even, would have done to the gravitational situation underneath and around the areas of where the swaddling band was. I don't know. But anyway, God promised a much better earthly environment for mankind to live. So actually, things were not ideal before the flood. This means that there was utter chaos in climatic conditions that resulted from the influence of the dark aerofell, which was eliminated with the flood of Noah. That ring system of water or ice that once surrounded the earth was eliminated when the water in that reservoir in heaven came to earth. Now, thankfully, we have a very pleasant type of earth that we know of today. I mean, in general, we have normal seasonal patterns, and there's some disruption. But, you know, on the whole, winter comes in winter, and summer, the warmth comes in the summer, and the transitional periods occur in the spring and the autumn. There's no longer a dark aerofell surrounding the earth. Its waters now make up part of the oceans, the Dead Sea and the other basin areas, the Caspian Sea, Lake Chad and the Great Lakes in North America, and even the waters of Lake Van near where the ark rested in the time of Noah. That's where those waters came from. When we understand just what happened during the flood of Noah, we are not compelled to identify many or all of the fossil evidences found in some of the highest of the mountains, which had, as having been caused by the flood a little over 4,300 years ago. Now, since Dr. Martin has a research study called The Story of Creation, which is not online on the website, this research study shows that the first account of creation recorded in Genesis chapter 1:1-2:3 is simply a blueprint of the creation that God would accomplish. In other words, he was telling Adam what he had done and laid out the blueprint. Well, I did this on day one, I did this on day two. This is Dr. Martin's understanding of Genesis 1:1-2:3 of the days. It wasn't that God did it on those 6 days of creation, but that God related them to Adam over a 6 day period or 7 day period. It's not required that we look on those 6 days of creation as referring to the earth itself. Those 6 days were periods of time in heaven when God designed his divine blueprint for the formation of our present heavens and earth. The actual formation of the earth for mankind is given from Genesis 2:4 onward. Now, this earth that we inhabit today may well have been in actual existence for several billions of years with numerous flood conditions occurring over the surface during that period of time. But the last flood that completely submerged the earth was that of Genesis chapter 1, not Noah's flood. And Dr. Martin says that he hopes that this true way of looking at Noah's flood will be seriously considered by the various scientists around the world. And when we really understand what the Bible has to say about the past history of the earth, things will make excellent scientific sense, as well as show the ordinary layperson the common sense way of looking at the teachings of the Bible. So that ends Bible Secret chapter 99, Bible Secret number 99. And we have two more to go. And I'd like to put those off for another time. And my personal research in regard to this whole business of creation, I agree what Dr. Martin is saying about the aerofall, but I'm not so sure and certain. I just have suspended judgment until I get more information as to the Genesis chapter 1:1-2:3 bit of information and other things. It's not that I disagree with Dr. Martin, it's just that I don't want to commit, I don't want to say in my own mind that that's what it was. And, you know, there's a lot of information out there, and I've been tracking with some of the various creationist groups in this area in Oregon where I am, and I am just undecided as to how these things work out and play out. So, you know, make up your own mind and have fun with this, because this is, you know, we'll all know someday, yeah. But at present, I don't know, and, you know, beyond that, I, you know, Dr. Martin has his research that he puts forth, and I certainly respect his material that he's put forth, and the Aerofel stuff. Others have spoken about that too, but he wrote about that actually quite a while ago, before others, and, you know, I don't, whether the others discovered it on their own or what, I don't know, but I've never seen anyone reference him, Dr. Martin, for this. But, you know, it doesn't matter. The word in Job is well known in creationist, and I think he's correct there. But how this played out in the time frame, there's evidence that the Earth is billions of years, and there's evidence that the Earth is very young. There's evidence that the redshift in space indicates that it's billions of years, and yet I've heard wonderful, excellent, elegant presentations that show that it's, you know, essentially the universe is not that old, and the time dilation effects of general and specific relativity can actually be explained mathematically. So, you know, I just having fun with it, and I don't feel like I have to be dogmatic about creation and the flood, and anything before the flood is open to speculation as
yeah.
far as I'm concerned.
But you know, David, it's a fascinating topic. It really is.
It is. It is.
And I don't think it's all that crucial to
no.
our salvation that we know the exact hour and moment, you know, that the Earth was created, and, you know.
And I'm somewhat distressed that the creationists fight amongst themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And the,
yeah.
the intelligent design people fight with all the creationists, and there's
oh,
the
yeah.
young Earth creationists and the old Earth creationists. It's fine, but I think to a certain extent they should keep this in-house. There
yeah.
are some wonderful research being done in the various organizations, and I'm not going to name any, but just look them up on the, you know, on the internet yourself. But there is some incredible work being done. My wife and I attended a lecture just yesterday at OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, and they had a fellow who discovered a duck-billed dinosaur. And I forgot to mention, Georgianne and I spoke about this earlier.
Yeah.
But they found patterns of skin on this, completely, on both sides of this dinosaur. So now we know what the skin pattern looks like, the scale pattern. They might even be able to determine color, just even though this is all fossilized. They're able to drill into the bones, and they have extracted parts of DNA, just like Jurassic Park. But, of course, adding frog DNA will not make up finish the sequence like they had in the movie and in the book by Michael Crichton. But they are able to extract DNA. Now, this is the third dinosaur they've been able to extract DNA from. One was from a Tyrannosaurus rex, and the other was, I don't know what kind of dinosaur that was. Now, if we're told that these dinosaur fossils are 77 million years old, well, somebody has to come up with an explanation as how can DNA survive that long, you know, and not be fossilized or, you know, just deteriorate. And this thing would have had to have been buried quickly. And there's no sign of trauma. They have a complete skeleton with skin structure on it. They're even able to determine what this thing ate.
Wow.
It's just unbelievable. And it had an upper gastrointestinal tract and a lower gastrointestinal tract, and there were different things in each tract, and they're able to determine this means that this thing traveled.
Oh, my goodness.
The different areas, not necessarily large areas, but, you know, from a wooded area to a swampy area. They found ferns. They found fir tree cones in the stomach, or at least indicators of, they're able to determine somehow that the exact contents of the stomach of this thing. Now, they could also, perhaps, this creature had 200 teeth. Perhaps they can get additional DNA. And when I asked him this question, he lightened up and didn't commit himself, but he said, yeah, we're looking into that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, in the roots,
mm-hmm.
that's a good source of DNA. I would think that something that is buried and fossilized quickly would be more reasonable that it was 7,000 years old than 77 million years old.
Yeah, they really, you know, it's disturbing in a sense that they throw around these millions of years figures.
They have to,
you know. Like,
and they're always going farther out, you notice.
Yeah.
You know, 100 years ago, well, it was 3-4 million. Now it's 3.2 billion, and now it's 4.2 billion for the creation of the universe. Which, by the way, the whole, you know, the evolutionists are essentially saying that you and I came from rock, which is spontaneous generation. Now, if that's not a miracle, harder to believe than God creating us, then what is? You know, I mean, that's a fantasy. A creator is not a fantasy.
Well, you know, there had to be a time frame that the universe, that our local universe, was organized. You know, there has to be a time frame when this planet was put, if it was put, in the position that it's in relation to everything else. I mean, we're way out here on the edge.
Right. And that's for a reason. They now know that if we were closer to the center, wouldn't be able to see anything, that we wouldn't be able to distinguish. If we were closer to the farther out from the galaxy, we wouldn't be able to see our relationship to the galaxy or to other galaxies.
Wow.
So that they're now compiling hundreds and hundreds of conditions that we just, if we were outside or if the condition was less, we wouldn't be able to survive for this reason, if our condition was more. If we did not have the visual range that we have today, you know, if we were more ultraviolet or infrared, we wouldn't be able to function the way we function today to build things and to observe the universe. The scripture says that the stars and the heavens were for signs. Well, that's a very broad term, signs. It doesn't just mean for the seasons. I mean, you could develop a calendar in 3 years once the Earth settled down. So there's nothing to that just by watching the stars. And if you're out there all the time without any lights for reading, you know, you pay attention to those things because they're awe-inspiring and they're big and they're out there and everybody's talking about it. Well, what is that star and what is that star? And it says specifically that God named the stars and that each star of the billions and billions, there's billions just in our galaxy.
Yeah.
And each of those stars has a name, and each of the stars in every galaxy has a name. Not just because it doesn't just mean the stars that we can see, it means every single star. Now, first of all, we're going to have a lot of memorization going on here.
Yeah.
Because we're going to learn all those names. And, you know, once we get out there in the resurrection, and because that will be the job and the function of the Gentile ecclesia, the Gentile church, if you say, if you wish, but I prefer ecclesia. Once we get out there, and then we will be told and we will know in our process of education exactly, you know, what was understood, what was to be understood, and what the creation process was, what took place before the flood. And, you know, it'll, Dr. Martin felt that there's going to be an education process for the first 70 years once Christ returns, because you have to get everybody up to speed. We're not going to know everything right away. We'll have total recall and, you know, minds that will, you know, are will be never forget anything, and you will have the capacity to understand things much, much faster and greater, simply because of your, you won't be, get tired, you won't have to sleep, you won't have to, you know, you won't slump in your chair like you used to do in school, George Ann. And, you know, we all did.
School was very boring to me.
Well, this won't be, because we'll get tours, believe me.
Wow.
And it'll be beautiful. You go on the NASA websites and you see these beautiful things that are projected. Well, a lot of those are artificial colors, but they still, nonetheless, those are colors literally that they apply, because they're actually signal responses that there are no colors. It's beyond our visual range. So they apply colors just for our, you know, convenience. So, yeah, to a certain extent, they're making things up, including the colors. But nonetheless, it does show the marvels of God's creation, exactly like it says in Psalm 19. Read Psalm 19, where there's a direct comparison between the stars and the heavens and how they speak to us, just like the Word of God speaks to us.
Yeah.
And someday they will. And at one time, before the flood, and probably for a period of time after the flood, the stars in the heavens, each of which have a name, and the ones we can see particularly, were probably known before the flood. And they're reflected in the Arabic names. And there is literally several books by Professor Seiss, S-E-I-S-S, and Dr. Bullinger called Gospel in the Stars.
I have that. That's very interesting.
Which one do you have?
Both of those.
Yeah, I have both of them too. And they're both fascinating, and they project in these books that the Gospel in the Stars was literally written in the names of the stars, you know, and that they told the story of creation. Of course, they didn't tell about the mystery, and they, you know, didn't really tell about Israel, because this was all before Israel was created. There was something there, but it didn't really state it in the Gospel of the Stars. But they knew that there was a Redeemer coming, and it was written in the stars, plus the stories of the patriarchs would have told, you know, during the day or in the evening as they taught their children.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though they were sinners, this idea got carried down, and they could write before the flood, and apparently Noah took those with him on the ark, in much in the same way that Daniel preserved the scriptures after the destruction of Jerusalem, because that was his job, one of many. So a lot of this stuff all dovetails together, and it's going to be a fascinating story, and we're all going to be part of it. And, you know, it's just, it's mind-boggling when you understand what God has in mind for us, and we're all going to know the past, and we're going to be able to talk to these people. We're going to be able to, all right, Noah, now what really went on?
Yeah.
And Shem and Japheth, and I don't know about Ham, but certainly Shem and Japheth will probably be there, and all the other pre-flood patriarchs. The names of the patriarchs before the flood also tell a story.
Yes.
And, you know, that's also an interesting. Compile the names and the translations in various translations, English translations, write them down and list them, and you'll see how they kind of tell a story. And that's an interesting study in itself. So study the scriptures and study to show yourself approved of God, because that's what really counts.
You're right. You know, David, I've got a kind of a question. You know, we're told that the internet just buzzes with people arguing about when the tribulation will begin. Well, I don't know, but in my way of thinking, the tribulation has been going on now for a while. You know, I mean, go talk to the little girls that were beheaded in Indonesia, little
yeah.
Christian girls. Go talk to the Christians in Darfur, in Africa. Why is there so much of this business? People just occupy themselves with, when will the tribulation begin? I know I'll get my head cut off. Why? What's that all about?
I don't know. Paul says you will always have tribulation, and Peter kind of indicates that if you don't have tribulation, you're doing something right. If you're not being persecuted, you might be Laodicean in. Now, there's a certain time where you're supposed to be, wise as a serpent and meek as a dove. Lay low. And we're not there yet, at least in the Western world. But if I was in Darfur and in Indonesia, you know, that's the time to, you don't wear it on your sleeve that you're a Christian.
Well,
that's probably best to move and leave town or leave the country even. While you still can.
People will say, well, you know, if I don't witness for Jesus, then I'm no good. I want to be a martyr for Jesus. Well, in a sense, I look at it, a dead Christian is of use to no one.
Well, that's their decision.
Yeah.
Based on their limit of understanding.
Good point.
You know, you can't criticize them for that. Look what Paul chose. Paul was told not to go up to Jerusalem, but he was arrested.
Yeah.
And he did it anyway.
Yeah.
Did Paul disobey? Maybe. And so then he had to go through the couple of imprisonments by the Romans. Several, in fact. But God ended up doing what he wanted accomplished with that individual. In that case, Paul. And likewise, everything that he intends for us to accomplish, even if it's just to be an example. And sometimes I feel like my purpose is to be a negative example, but nonetheless. That's how you feel sometimes, because you're not really, you know, you wonder why you're not really, you know, being used the way that you think you should be used.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that way, but I know a lot of people who do. You know, well, I'm just sitting here like a lump and growing older. But, you know, God is using you as an example. If not now, then for later, when you come back and teach the people that you knew during this lifetime, and that when you are strong and vigorous and they're resurrected to the physical, but you're a spirit being, they will recognize you. And they will remember, because remember, God, actually, I need to do a study sometime on the books that God has, that he keeps.
Yes, yes.
It's mentioned more than just in Revelation.
Yeah, I'm very interested in that topic. The Book of the Lamb, the Book of Life.
Yeah.
What does that really mean to us?
To study this stuff right, it takes time. You don't want to just, because you have to make sure the translations are correct,
right?
Whether you have the correct understanding of the Greek or the Hebrew, whether the New Testament authors altered the meaning, which they had every right to do, and did they alter the meaning because they were correcting the common understanding of their day? Or were they adding additional information to what was in the Hebrew? Sometimes it's one and sometimes it's the other. So, in Hebrews 2:7, there's a verse that is from the Psalms, and Paul is pinpointing the meaning of that psalm. In that psalm, it uses the term Elohim.
Yes.
Paul uses the term in Hebrews 2:7, he uses the term angel.
Yeah.
Well, angels are Elohim, but he is qualifying.
Your phone is acting funny right now.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't hear any problems, so maybe we should take this as a technological sign that we should stop. But.
Okay. Well, David, really, I mean, the things you bring to the table are so interesting and thought-provoking. And I sincerely hope it will encourage people to dig into the scriptures and study. And go to askelm.com, the website. There is a wealth of information up there. And I also noticed, David, that you have your writing about the idolatry and the sons of God.
Right.
Yes.
Right. There's one article by Dr. Martin about idolatry. Then I've written two, Idolatry and the Sons of God. And then this month's article is Idolatry and God's Punishment. And there will be another article, not next month or even the following month, but probably in, that would be in June, Jesus and the Sons of God. In other words, what's Jesus' relationship as the only begotten Son of God,
right,
in relation to the other sons of God. And once again, this is all coming off of information developed by Dr. Martin and his research. So
right.
This is all fascinating stuff, and the more we delve into it, hopefully the more we're clarifying exactly what God is trying to communicate to us.
Wow. Well, once again, God bless you. And for the listeners out there, if you have questions, email David Seeloff. If you appreciate what he does, his research, his work, please email him and let him know. That is called good manners. Anyway, you can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And once again, be sure to go to the website, askelm.com. The article about idolatry and the sons of God, fascinating. Very, very fascinating. I'd sure like everybody to read it, because David and I are going to do some more audio files on these topics. And it would be nice if the audience were caught up to the material that we're going to cover, because it's really interesting and very deep. So, this is George N. Hughes with David Seeloff, God bless him, signing off, and we will be back, God willing. Good night, everybody, and God bless every one of you listening. Good night.